I don't know about you, but I feel a lot of sympathy for Jesus' first followers because they had one shocking, confusing, amazing experience with him one after the other. They had no sooner experienced one of these things than he says some amazing thing and they can't understand. And this is especially true in today's passage in Mark chapter 5. What happens here is actually one of three, it's the middle one, number two, of three amazing things that they saw Jesus do and say, and I don't know how they survived the day. Jesus' disciples in this chapter, the previous chapter, chapter 4, the end of it, they're in a boat with him crossing over the Sea of Galilee, which is no sea at all. It's a large lake, about 13 miles long and 8 miles wide at its widest. And while they're out there, one of the famous storms that frequents that area just blew up out of nowhere. Wind and rain and waves, and their little boat wasn't ready for it, and it was overloaded with the disciples, and it began to take on water and threatened to sink. The disciples begged Jesus to do something. They didn't say what, they just begged him to do something, and I don't know what they had in mind, but what he did, I doubt, was what he had in mind. Because all he did in the midst of the storm was stand up and say, "Quiet, be still." Okay, well, I don't know what they expected to happen when they asked him to help, but I know they didn't expect what did happen. It just stopped. The wind and the waves just calmed back down, and the boat was saved. They were saved. And they were shocked. They were so shocked. Look at what they said in chapter 4, verse 41, leading into our chapter for today. They were terrified, not of the storm, because the storm's over. They were terrified of him. They were terrified, and they asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." Okay, so I'm not there, okay? But if I was there, I'd say, "Boys, since I know what's going to happen, I'd say, boys, if you think that was amazing, why don't you see what happens next?" Chapter 5, verse 1. They went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes, and when Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an impure spirit from the tombs came to meet him. This man lived in the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. If this were a Hollywood horror film, it would have to be rated at least R because it's so scary and so gross. As soon as Jesus got out of the boat, a man possessed of evil spirits confronted him. He came up to Jesus. And this bizarre guy lived in the town cemetery. Okay, and it's worse than that. The wording is such that he lived in the tombs. He slept in the tombs. And you know, back then, they buried most people in a cave, either a natural cave that occurred by nature, or a cave that they had carved out of the stone. Not like we do today. We dig a hole in the ground. That's where we bury people. But they buried him in caves, and to keep the wild animals from getting in and do what wild animals do with dead bodies, they would roll a stone that was carved in the shape of a wheel. They would roll it in front of the opening to this tomb where all the family members were born, and then no one could get in. So really, all this demon-possessed man had to do, and he seemed to be possessed of superhuman strength because he just kept breaking the chains off. All he had to do was roll one of those stones away, and then he could go in and sleep with whoever was dead in there. And that's what he did. And it's worse than that. This is why it might be more than an R rating. Since at the end of the story, Mark makes a point of saying that the man was dressed. Okay, well, in the beginning of the story, he's naked. That's the way he lived. He lived naked and yelling and screaming and living in the tombs with the dead bodies. And he was so out of control and wild that the people had tried to get him under control with the handcuffs and the leg shackles and chains and all of that, but he kept breaking out of them. Not easy to do. Even back then, the chains were strong enough and the ankle bracelets were strong enough to hold you. It says, no one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. So he would terrorize anybody who came close. Can you imagine if you had a funeral for a family member and you had to go to that cemetery and you knew he lived there and that he was going to give you a hard time? Or if you were traveling down the road and you had to pass by, he's there. He's not going to leave you alone. He's going to be the wild man. And so I wonder, you know, should we feel sorry for him, this tormented guy? Or should we be terrified of him? Or maybe both, terrified and sorry for him. And then I wonder, what caused him to be possessed by evil spirits? Was he involved in some terrible sins over a long period of time? Or did he intentionally become a Satan worshiper, and that's how he became possessed by evil spirits? Now, I don't want you to automatically assume which... Raise your hand if you've ever seen a guy like this living in a cemetery. No, okay? I don't want you to assume that because you've never seen a guy like this, they don't exist in modern times. Because they do. And I'm going to tell you about one. Every time I read this passage of Scripture, I think of the naked, violent people, all men. No, not all men. Mostly men. I dealt with in the Philadelphia Police Department. Usually I blame their behavior on drugs and mental illness. But when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask, because I wouldn't be surprised if some of them were possessed of evil spirits. One hot summer afternoon, I was supervising two districts in South Philadelphia, and it was hot. Did I mention it was hot? Yeah, it was very hot. And a radio assignment came out, and the dispatcher announced the following job. We have a naked man armed with an AK-47 rifle, blocking traffic and screaming in the middle of Broad Street, which is a four-lane road that goes north and south through Philadelphia, right through the center. And I thought, uh-oh, that sounds like something I should go to since I'm the supervisor. And I got there as fast as I could before the shooting started. When I got there, first thing I did was try to assess how accurate the dispatcher's assignment was, because a lot of times they're not very accurate. People leave stuff out, they add stuff, and sometimes people call 911 and give a job out like that when there's nothing going on. They think it's a joke on the police. But in this case, sure enough, there was a muscular, naked, very sweaty guy screaming and blocking all the traffic in all four lanes going both directions. Fortunately, the AK-47 rifle was laying in the street where he had dropped it. And then I concluded, well, we might be able to get through this without anybody getting shot. I looked around at the drivers and the pedestrians who were, you know, they're all stuck there. And I looked around and their eyes were like this big. And I'm thinking, they weren't saying anything, but they're saying, do something. So my mind immediately went to the last time I wrestled a naked, sweaty guy. And I knew it wasn't going to be easy. Even if we outnumber him 2 or 3 to 1, because there's nothing to grab onto. Because if you grab his arm, he's all sweaty and it's going to slip out of your hands. If you grab him by the neck, his head's going to slip off. And so it's not easy, and it's usually pretty messy. And my mind also went to this passage, because it's just, you know, it's the same guy. It's just 2,000 years later, and he's in the middle of Broad Street, in the middle of Philadelphia. And so I silently asked Jesus, do it again. Do it again like he did that time. And I drew my taser because I figured I was going to need it. The first of many officers to back me up arrived at that point as I was getting out of my car. And the two of us approached the crazy, sweaty guy. Did I mention he was naked? And the officer approached him first, and I covered him with the taser in case I needed to give him 5 seconds of the 50,000 volts. The officer, and I was impressed. I put him in for a commendation later because I don't know how he did this. But he calmed the guy down. He started talking to him. He said, "It's going to be okay. Come on, let's come on over here." And I said, "Get him in the back of that police car." The door was open to another police car that just arrived. And my hope was if we could get him in the back of the police car, he can't get out. The doors don't open from the inside, and we could at least keep him in there. Because if he gets out, and, you know, he's already out, but if he gets away, who knows what he's going to do. So the officer calmed him down, and he quit screaming, and he quit pounding on the cars. And I thought we were going to have an easy time. So, but we didn't. We almost got him in the back of the police car when he just went wild again. I don't know what happened in his mind, but police officer was talking to him, and all of a sudden he just went crazy. And so I let him have it with the taser. 5 seconds, 50,000 volts. He fell to the ground, like they do, in case you've never seen it. And so during that 5 seconds, we were able to get him handcuffed behind his back. And when he stopped being shocked, we picked him up, and he's yelling and screaming and spitting in our faces, and we put him in the back of the police car. I threaded my taser with the wire still attached through the window and closed the door. Thank goodness he's locked in the police car. And I still have the taser. I can do it again if I have to. The prongs are still in him and the wires are still attached. Those are the two most important things you have to know. And I begged or called over radio, I don't know what the difference is, for the prisoner van to hurry up and get here because he's not going to last long in a police car. We need to get the van here as fast as possible. And while I was doing that, that was about how long he stayed calm again. And he began to go crazy in the back of the police car again. And the police car was going like this, because he's, you know, thrashing around in the back of there. And mind you, with his hands behind his back. Okay? And he's thrashing around. I said, okay, this is not a problem. He can't get out, so we're just going to stay. The window was down about that much so he could have some air. After he was done for a couple seconds banging around on the inside of the car, he stopped and he looked at the window. And I said, oh, no. He looked at the window and his hands behind his back. And he attacked the window with his forehead. The glass exploded out onto the asphalt. And I said, that's it. Give him another 5 seconds of 50,000 volts. And I screamed at all the cops who had not arrived, get him out of there and into the van, which had also arrived. So he calmed down, but mind you, in the back of my head, I have seen naked, demon-possessed guys take 8 taser shocks. It's a total of 40 seconds, and by then the battery's dead. You're done. You might as well just put the taser down. It's going to be hand-to-hand now. And so I said, okay, that's 2. I tasered him again, so I had to, it only works. The wires broke, so I had to take the old cartridge out and put my one backup cartridge, into the taser in case I needed to give it to him a third time or more. So we had him out on the ground next to the van. They stood him up, and we're going to try to put him in the van. And even though there were 6 or 7 cops holding on to him, he just flipped out again. And I had to taser him for the third time. But that was enough to keep him calm for 5 more seconds, and we could get him into the van, close the door and lock it. There's nothing he could do there. There's no windows. So the way I looked at it, Jesus answered my prayer. He did it again, but it was a lot messier than it was the first time in Mark 5. And he didn't end up sitting at the feet of Jesus listening to his every word. And so I want you to know there are people still like that. That this is not an ancient thing. There are people still like that today. And that Jesus is healing some of them. Well, I do want to say that I'm not an expert in demon possession. There are some people who are. I'm not. But my study of history tells me that demon possession happens more or less in various times and places. We might not see it today, but you might see it in Africa somewhere, or China, or whatever. So it comes and goes. I've also noticed that what I think of demon possession could easily be confused with some forms of mental illness, or drug addiction, or drug intoxication. And so personally, sometimes I'm not sure. Normally I would think, okay, that's drugs or that's mental illness. But then I'm thinking, maybe it's demon possession too, or instead. And this is because those who are afflicted often act out, afflicted with mental illness, in bizarre ways, and they're very hard to control, like this guy. Psychiatrists, who are in charge of labeling people, I guess, label them often as psychopaths or sociopaths or even bipolar. And of course, a lot of those people are locked away in prisons and in mental hospitals, though many do live among us. And they do that because they manage to hide their symptoms, and they live among us. But you won't be fooled if they're in your family or where you work or you encounter someone like that on the street. When we lived in Philadelphia, there was a single mother with six kids who lived about as far from us, from our house, as this pulpit is from the parsonage up the hill behind us. We didn't know her at the time, but three of her six kids had come to our church's summer day camp. One day we learned from the TV news that she had been arrested for murdering her five-year-old daughter by locking her in the basement and starving her for over a month. Occasionally, this mother would put a little food or water on the top step of the basement and close the door and lock it again. But it was never enough. And the little girl banged on the door and begged for food and water. And after a month or so, because we don't really know, the kids told us later what happened. But it took about a month for her to starve to death and die. Well, at first, and for the longest time, the other kids wouldn't say anything to anybody because the mother had threatened them. You see what I did? You want some of that? So they didn't say anything. But finally, one of them let it slip. And whoever that child spoke to called the DHS and called police. And so one afternoon, a DHS social worker and two police officers showed up at the house to see if what they had heard was true. They went in the house, went down in the basement, and found the girl's little decomposed skeleton under the stairs, covered up with a pile of old clothes in a half-hearted attempt to hide what had happened. Can you imagine what that little girl went through for a month? And what about her siblings? You know, they didn't die, but gee, that was their sister who was being killed down there. Can you imagine the evil in a mother's heart capable of doing that? You know, it's not like she lost her temper and smacked her daughter and killed her, you know, just on a spur of the moment. She had to do this every day for a month. There was a lot of conscious, intentional effort to it. That would take a lot of evil, maybe even demon possession. And that's the kind of person Jesus met when he came out of the boat, the guy living in the cemetery. Okay, so we've got a picture of what Jesus faced when he came out of the boat. A demon-possessed naked man living among dead bodies, sleeping among dead bodies, eating among dead bodies in a cemetery, totally out of control, screaming and cutting himself. And this is what it says in verse 6. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him, and he shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In God's name, don't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you impure spirit." Then Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "My name is Legion," he replied, "for we are many." And he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. Isn't it interesting that unlike the Jewish leaders and many of the Jewish people, this demon-possessed Gentile knew immediately who Jesus was, the Son of the Most High God. I don't know where he got that from, but he was right. And he announced it loudly for all to hear. He was yelling it out. No big secret. Sometimes Jesus would tell his disciples early on, "Don't tell anybody who I am." And then later on, he let it out. Well, this guy, this is at the beginning of his ministry. He's shouting it at the top of his lungs like everything else he says. So mark my words. Just because you know that Jesus is the Son of God, that does not make you a Christian. Here's a demon who knew who he was. That was not a Christian. That was not a believer. That was a demon. Correct knowledge about God in your head or correct knowledge about God that you verbally repeat is not what makes a Christian. A Christian has faith in that God. A Christian asks for forgiveness for their sins and determines to live their life for God. That's what makes a real Christian, not just saying the words or even knowing the facts. So Jesus asked the demon what his name was, and I told you I wasn't an expert in demon possession. I didn't know they had names. And I didn't know it mattered either, but apparently it does. Jesus asked him, and he said, "My name is Legion." Ah, a Roman legion of soldiers was 6,000 men. So maybe that's what he's saying. There's 6,000 of us in here. Or maybe that's just a big word for it. There's a lot of us in here. And as we see what happens in a minute, when he cast the demons out, there were a lot of them in there. Whatever. This was probably the worst case of demon possession that Jesus and his disciples had ever seen. I know it's the worst case I've ever heard of myself. And like I said, not being an expert on demon possession, I'm a little uncertain why the demons begged Jesus to not cast them out of this area where they lived. They apparently knew they were going to be cast out of the man, but they didn't want to go very far. And again, not being an expert, I don't know what their problem is, but I'm thinking they have this whole town under their control. They got them terrified. So they want to go into somebody nearby so they can continue to terrorize the neighborhood. So the demons offered Jesus an alternative, as if they had a way to negotiate with him. They're negotiating with the Son of God. So this is what they said. A large herd of pigs was feeding on the nearby hillside. The demons begged Jesus, "Send us into the pigs. Allow us to go into them." He gave them permission, and the impure spirits came out and went into the pigs. The herd, about 2,000 in number, rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. If you're doing the math, that would be 3 demons per pig, or thereabouts. Jesus granted the demons their wish, but he had the last laugh on them at their expense. He cast the demons out of the man, which was his point, and into a herd of pigs, which is a huge herd of pigs. 2,000 is a lot of pigs. And for some reason, I don't understand, they all went crazy and ran off the cliff into the lake where Jesus had just come from, and they drowned. I think pigs can swim, so I don't know why they drowned. But they're all dead now, 2,000 pigs floating in the lake. Now, before I go on to my next point, I want to go off to a little side thing here, because I've never met anybody, but I have heard that some animal lovers criticize Jesus for this because he killed the 2,000 pigs, or he caused their death. All I've got to say about that is those pigs were being raised for meat, right? You know, bacon and stuff. So it was just a matter of time before every one of them was slaughtered and eaten. So whether they died today or next month, I don't think it really matters. And Jesus cares more about people than pigs. That maybe we could go with that explanation. Now, do you think Jesus' disciples ever saw anything like that before? First, they never saw a demon-possessed guy like that. They never saw that before. And do you think they ever saw anybody cast out demons like that were so powerful? I don't think so. And so their heads, they just came out of the lake where he said, "Quiet, be still," and the waves stopped. Now they come up to the cemetery, and he does this. So who is this guy? Imagine the guys herding the pigs. They weren't out there by themselves. There were men who were herding the pigs. They didn't know who Jesus was. They never heard a word he ever said before. They don't know his mission. You know, they didn't see the miracle on the lake. But they did notice this. He cast the demons out of this guy, and their pigs ran over the cliff and drowned. You know, they're responsible for those pigs. They got to turn them in at the end of the day. So they're in trouble if they don't come up with a good story. And I think they have a good story. And that's what they did. Verse 14. Those tending the pigs ran off and reported this in the town and the countryside. And the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told about the pigs as well. Then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. Wait a minute. They were afraid and they begged him to leave? Didn't he just do this great thing and save this guy's life? He saved the notorious demon-possessed man, and instead of being thankful and impressed, the people from the town became afraid of Jesus and begged him to go away. How can that be? Here's how it can be. It was a case of mistaken identity. They fouled it all up about who he was. They knew all about the naked demon-possessed guy because they had to deal with him any time they came by. And they knew they couldn't control him. They tried. They tried chaining him up. They tried everything. They couldn't control him. And here was a guy who did something to him, and look at this, what happened. But they make an incorrect assumption about who Jesus was. They assumed if Jesus, this stranger to them, could control the demons and cast them out of the pigs, into the pigs, then his evil power must be even greater than the demons' evil power. So the way they looked at it, they had just gone from the frying pan into the fire because now something worse than those demons is here. That's what they assumed about Jesus. They mistakenly believed that he was bad. They understood the power, but they figured it was evil power. What a terrible mistake. They had a chance to meet the Son of God, and they just kicked him out of town instead. But there was one person in town who didn't make that mistake. The demon-possessed man was sitting at the foot of Jesus, who was teaching, with clothes on now, and in his right mind now, listening to what Jesus had to say. He knew what Jesus had done, and he was grateful and wanted to become one of Jesus' followers. Perfectly natural. What the other people did was kind of strange, but what he did was perfectly natural. But Jesus had a better idea. Verse 18. As Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. Jesus did not let him, but said, "Go home to your own people and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So the man went away and began to tell in the Decapolis, which is 10 towns. 10 Decapolis means Deca, 10 and Polis city, how much Jesus had done for him, and all the people were amazed. All too often, I think we're prone to believing that the best thing a Christian could ever do in life would be to go and be a missionary for Jesus in Africa or China or, God forbid, California. Jesus does call some people to be missionaries, but most people he gives the exact same assignment that he gave this guy. He tells us to go home and tell everybody you know what the Lord has done for you. Think about it. What a wonderfully powerful witness it would be back home for the people who knew him and knew what he had been like, for him to come home and say, I'm better. And of course, they would be a little frightened until they figured it out that he was better. They knew all about the demon possession and living in at the cemetery with the dead bodies. They had probably tried to help him. They loved him and bring him to his senses unsuccessfully. Imagine how impressed they would be when he said that this Jesus guy saved me. And in the process, he became the first Christian and the first Christian missionary in that country east of the Jordan River, which is known to us today as Jordan. There's a lot to learn from this passage. We could pick it apart. If I had an assignment, I could do 5 sermons on this one thing, but I'm not going to. But I am going to focus at the end here on what we can learn from the town's reaction to Jesus after they begged him to go away. It's sad to say, but a lot of people today misunderstand or misidentify Jesus. Many people mistakenly believe Jesus and his followers are doing their best to take all the fun out of life for them. That's what they think. They believe the life that Jesus calls his followers to is a life that is dull and boring, and they don't want dull and boring. They want exciting. On the contrary, though, Jesus says, "I've come that they might have life and have it more abundantly," or have it to the full. That's John 10:10. The problem these people have is a mistaken and distorted view of what makes for a great life. To them, they want to be able to sin in any way they want and have no one stop them or criticize them. Secondly, many people get it really mixed up and mistakenly come to believe that Jesus is actually a force for evil. Satan worshipers are this way. And these people believe that Jesus' followers are a force for evil also. And you can see examples of that today in our country right now. Do you realize that the FBI and the Department of Defense are training their agents and their soldiers to believe that conservative Christian Americans are the greatest terrorist threat in this country? I'm not making it up. I'm not exaggerating it. I've seen the training slides that they put up on the wall to teach soldiers and agents about this. The most dangerous people you know are those conservative Bible-believing Christians. So many people in our government, some of our fellow citizens and neighbors, think we and Jesus are an evil threat to the so-called good things that they are in favor of, like abortion and transgender medical procedures for kids, censorship of ideas, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And this is exactly the way the townspeople misidentified Jesus. They said, he's evil, even though he cast out demons from the man living at the cemetery. They concluded that he was even more evil and more powerful than the demons. So they begged him to go away without even trying to find out who he was and where his power came from. Didn't even ask, they just go away. And then finally, a lot of people who aren't even followers of Jesus or believers in God receive blessings from God. He says, I cause the rain to fall on the good and the evil. And so a lot of people experience blessings from God that they don't realize came from God. They think it came because they're so great, or they came because it was just luck, or they're that shallow they don't even think where this stuff came from that they have. So they take blessings from God and they simply just walk away unimpressed. They're not thankful. They don't put their faith in God. They don't make a U-turn in life and start living for God. They just walk away unconcerned. About 45 years ago, you thought I was only 45, right? Well, I'm older than 45. About 45 years ago, June and I, my wife, were sitting on the beach in Rhode Island when a guy swimming pretty far offshore started waving and screaming for help. Help, I'm drowning, help, help. Okay, there's never been lifeguards at this private beach. But there is a 4x4 stuck in the sand at the high water mark, and on it is a big spool of 150 feet of rope and a life-saving buoy. So all of us men jumped up from our towels and our beach chairs and we ran over and grabbed the buoy and the rope and we ran to the surf. Three guys took the buoy and started taking it out into the water. They started swimming. The rest of us held onto the rope because we were going to pull them in once they got to the drowning guy. There are about 12 of us involved in that rescue. Once the three swimmers took the buoy out to the drowning man, the rest of us on the rope began just pulling it in. And the swimmers swam alongside of him in case he let go or, you know, something happened on the way in. When everyone got back safely to shore, something totally unexpected happened, which illustrates how people often just walk away from God. The drowning guy who was rescued from dying, walked out of the surf, dropped the buoy in the sand, and left. Not a thank you, not a handshake, didn't look anybody in the eye, just walked away. And we were all shocked. It was total silence. I mean, we had been yelling and saying, pull, and but when he did that, we all just went, what did we see? What happened here? Isn't that just like the townspeople in this passage, begging Jesus to go away after he has cast out the demons from the demon-possessed naked guy and restored him to sanity, that they just want to walk away? So I say, let none of us ever walk away from God the same way as that guy did, as if we don't know who he is or we don't understand all the blessings he has given us. Let's instead be like that demon-possessed man sitting at the feet of Jesus, dressed and in his right mind, soaking up his wisdom and love, and thankful to have been saved. Let's pray. Tell us, Father, sometimes we just don't get it. And what we don't get sometimes is extremely important, of the most importance. Help us to understand that you have the power over evil. At the snap of your fingers, it obeys you. And help us understand that these gifts that you give us and your identity call us to sit at your feet and worship you and live our lives for your sake. That's what we ask. And we ask it in his name. Amen.